In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today on Word Balloon, we talk with comic book writer and radio broadcaster Steve Darnall. Is the name familiar? It should be. Back in the 90s, he and Alex Ross did the two-issue miniseries Uncle Sam, a very political tome, not the quality superhero that we all remember. Steve worked on a lot of fringe genre books as the comic market struggled to survive after the speculation era went bust. You'll hear about his work as well on parody romantic comics for Slave Labor Graphics and his own company, Funny Valentine. But more importantly, we're here to talk about old-time radio superheroes, some of which predated Superman in Action Comics number one. Steve is the host of two old-time radio programs, Those Were the Days and Yesterday USA. We'll talk about the origins of the Lone Ranger and Green Hornet, first created for radio, and then the 1940s Superman radio serial. It's all brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. They offer a wide variety of comic book trade paperbacks, graphic novels, absolute editions, omnibus editions, essentials, books about comics, all at reduced prices off the standard retail price. In fact, if you make a purchase of $50 or more, you'll get free shipping at InStockTrades.com. One of the publishers we mentioned in our conversation with Steve is Moonstone Books. Moonstone has been doing a lot of revivals of old radio properties, presenting detective stories and even pulp stories as well. You can find a lot of graphic novels of Moonstone Books at 25% off the standard retail price at InStockTrades.com. In addition, you'll find Steve and Alex Ross's Uncle Sam. You can get the deluxe hardcover edition. The standard retail price is $19.99, but at InStockTrades.com, you'll get it for $12.39. To find out all the great deals waiting for you, check out the website InStockTrades.com. Thank you so much for doing this. We have a mutual friend in comics, and probably more than the one that I'm going to mention, but the great Hillary Barta.
Wonderful guy.
And I was
Hillary's contributed to our magazine in the past, Nostalgia Digest.
That's really cool. And, you know, it's funny. I've been a longtime listener of Those Were the Days, both your own stewardship of the show and back when Chuck Schaden was doing the show. So it was really exciting to put two and two together when Hillary told me that his friend Steve was taking over an old-time radio show, and suddenly my eyes got big, and I said, I know Steve Darnall, and he goes, well, you know, do you realize, too, that that's the same guy that wrote Uncle Sam with Alex Ross?
Yes, I have. I've worn many different hats of varying sizes.
So, yeah, you know, I want to get into the radio stuff, but first let's talk about comics, and tell me about your time writing comic books. When did you get started, and beyond Uncle Sam, which I know is a wonderful book.
I was sentenced to write in comics. When did my sentence begin? No, I actually sort of got in the back way, which has sort of really stood me well throughout my life. I sort of got into it because I knew people who were in it. I mean, I had started reading comics in college. Some of them were great. You know, I mean, it was a very exciting time because people like Alan Moore and the Hernandez brothers were doing some amazing things. And in the early 90s, I found myself, I was back in Chicago and meeting people like Hillary and Alex Ross and Paul Fricke and Lennon Delsol and Mark Braun and Dan Clowes and a whole lot of others. And it demystified some of the process, you know, and eventually, I think a group of us who'd started hanging out together sort of got on this kick that, hey, we should do something sometime. And I came up with a romance comic called Empty Love Stories.
Yep.
Which not a lot of people got. I mean, not a lot of people purchased, and then those that did didn't always get it. But it was a chance to work with people like Hillary and Paul and Scott Biederstadt and Lennon. And we did four of those, and they were great fun. But like I say, it was not something I intended to do like annual additions to an encyclopedia.
Okay. Was this self-published or, you know,
Yeah, the first two issues were done by a company in California called Slave Labor Graphics.
Sure.
They did two, and after I did two with them, I sort of had this idea, oh, well, I'll bet I could do that. And thus I started a company called Funny Valentine Press. And it's not as easy as it looks. I learned that very quickly, you know. Dan and the crew at Slave Labor, you know, do an awful lot of that, and they do it very well. I was lucky that I did a book that I really only planned to publish once a year. And after a while, it became apparent that, you know, comics and I had spent a sufficient amount of time together. And I have no rancor about that. I got to do some things of which I'm very proud. Empty Love Stories was one. Uncle Sam, which you mentioned, of course, was another. I had the occasion to publish a benefit book on behalf of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, an organization out of Philadelphia, and we had about 35 creators contributing to that. So, I mean, I like to think that even if I retired early, I left with a reasonably good batting average.
That's really cool. Now, about the romance comics, because that's an area that I've spent very little time on, were you inspired by, you know, I don't know, DC certainly, you know.
Actual romance comics? Yeah. DC had done a book in the 80s, I think, a collection called Heartthrobs.
Okay.
Which, I know.
I remember Young Love and, you know, those kinds of 100-page, you know, giants. We're close to the same age, Steve. So,
yeah, yes, that's right, you know. We are. And, I mean, it was one of those things that to see a romance comic from 25 or 30 years ago, and this was 1987, I guess, I mean, intrinsically, it's funny because, of course, this is pre-sexual revolution. This is pre, you know, King and Kennedy and, you know, Nixon resigning and pre-Watergate and pre-Vietnam and all of those things. And, of course, this was at a time when the majority of comics were written by middle-aged white men.
Right.
A group against which I have no particular vendetta. But it occurred to me that if you were going to go looking around for a group that would be best equipped to give advice to adolescent girls, middle-aged white men are probably way down on the list. Probably way down. And so I just saw these stories where it was like, you know, all these, and the bit knuckles and the single tear forming.
Yes.
And it was just such a marvelous vocabulary that it just seemed right for parody. And so I call that my punk book because I was really just kind of taking the vocabulary of romance comics and trying to do something kind of snotty with them. You know,
it's just, sure.
I mean, you know, we did a story called One of the Walking Dead, and literally, I kid you not, I found a romance comic story in which this society girl falls in love with a longshoreman, and of course, both of their social circles think this is a mistake, but they try to make it work. And I just took out the longshoreman and replaced him with a zombie, and the story pretty much wrote itself.
That's awesome. Hey,
yeah.
Man, now I'm friends with Kirkman. Uh-oh. I smell some litigation. I don't know.
Oh, my God. I prayed. You know what? That's one thing, John, about my comic book career, to put that in quotes. I prayed for lawsuits. You know, we were talking about this the other day, you know, about all the nonsense Ed Brubaker had to go through with Fox. And I thought, I would love for Fox to have read my book.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you couldn't buy that kind of publicity. You know, I
understood.
Really was hoping some blowhard pundit would read Uncle Sam and go absolutely nuts and you know, we'd have to pose in photographs with the flag around or wrapped around us, but it never happened. So
now, this was in the 90s, correct?
Yeah, 97. Ellis and I did that.
And obviously, unfortunately, that was really kind of still the low point of comics. I don't think even, you know, things I'd say in the second half of, in the last couple of years, the boom that was happening, you know, in the mid-2000s seems to have leveled off, and I think comics is kind of dipped down again, but certainly not to the levels that they were in the very late 90s when the bust happened, the speculation bust.
Yeah, I can't recall. I mean, I do remember people at DC saying to me, you know, no offense, but you've actually written Alex Ross's worst-selling book.
Oh, man! Well, congratulations.
I know what they mean. I mean, it was a mature reader's title, and it didn't have Superman or Batman or Captain Marvel or Captain America, and I respect that. It was what it was. But you're right. But I know that it sold better than anything I'd ever done.
Cool.
And also, I mean, you know, it's one of those things. Yeah, I it was a very personal book for Alex and myself, and when you do something like that, you clearly hope it will catch on with a large number of people, but you can't really be unhappy if it doesn't, because that's what happens when you do something that's intensely personal.
Well, and further, I think the audience, and especially the DC audience, when they heard probably that Alex Ross was doing Uncle Sam, you know, they were thinking of the quality superhero, the freedom fighter.
that guy that teamed with Dollman and the Black Condor and stuff, and we're probably really, you know, I was expecting that as well, but being the political junkie that I was and leaning left, I appreciated the dark humor that you guys brought and the real serious, you know, comment that you guys were making as well. So it was really cool.
Jeff Smith told us once, you know, that he thought it was a 96-page political cartoon.
Yes.
And that's probably as good a summary as anything. And you're right, and that's not something that was an automatic sell then as now. But, you know, it's like street theater. You don't automatically assume you're going to reach everybody, but you hope you're going to reach somebody, and when you do, that's one more person who gets your message that didn't have it before.
Very cool.
And I have absolutely no regrets about, you know, the reactions we got or the story we told. And, you know, I was very, very grateful that even if we got to open a window of dialogue slightly, that maybe we got to open it. So I don't want to pat myself on the back too much because clearly the book did not save America, which was the goal.
No, that's true. Unfortunately, I understand, man.
But I understand, you know, it's hopefully it in turn maybe got somebody to read it and think, all right, well, whatever I thought of this book, at least these guys weren't afraid to come out and say what they thought.
And maybe
I should do the same thing. So.
Well, and further, I think, especially for an established guy like Alex, it was interesting to see him come out politically, and that wasn't the last time that he did it. I mean, I know that great print that he made a couple years ago of Bush as a vampire taking a bite out of it was the Statue of Liberty, of course, I believe.
Right.
Yeah.
Alex actually, I remember, wanted to do a cover for the Sam collection of Uncle Sam flipping the bird.
Oh, I've seen that. I believe I've seen that image.
Yeah. I mean, I think he wanted to do a die-cut cover because, of course, those were all the rage 15 years ago.
Sure.
you know?
The 90s.
And, yeah, with the 90s, oh, yeah. it was finally publishing comics caught up with publishing books in the 70s. Way to go. and I think, in fact, I think DC actually was all set to give him the go-ahead on it. And it was just, it struck me as gratuitous. So I was the prude who kiboshed that one. Sorry, America.
Funny.
Yeah. But it was a fabulous time. And you know, I always sort of likened it to going to a really nice party, John, because I went in, I met some interesting people, I had a great time. When it looked like things were winding down, I picked up and went home.
Understood. And,
yeah.
Well, that's too bad because, and, you know, I know, like I said, it was, it, you know, things were bottoming out. But, you know, I think I would be very interested to see some of those Funny Valentine comics and those romance comics of yours.
Oh, there may still be a few floating around. So, yeah, remind me when we're done. I'll see if there's any left in the crypt.
Oh, that'd be terrific. Thank you. Well, and then, you know, another reason why we're having you on today is to talk about radio. And as I said, you took over this really Chicago institution when it comes to old-time radio. I mean, those were the days started in, was it 1970 or
1970, yeah. We're about to celebrate 41 years on the air.
Man.
Yeah, I was very, very fortunate. I had cultivated an affection for the golden age of radio when I was very young, and it had a huge impact on virtually everything I've done in my adult life, as anything does when you catch it at a good age. And when Chuck Shaden announced his plans to retire from radio in 2009, my first thought was it would be a real shame if this show were not to be on the air, or if old-time radio were not to be on the air, because I had come to rely on it, and I know I wasn't alone. And also, not to put too fine a point on it, I published a magazine, the Nostalgia Digest, which listed the schedule for those were the days. So, you know, if that's 8 pages, I'm going to have to fill every time if that's not scheduled. So, when Chuck and I talked about it, and we sort of came to feel it was important that there be an old-time radio show on the air in this area, and the more we talked about it and the more Chuck thought about how he felt and how his listeners felt, I think to his credit, he thought it was important that those were the days be that show. He could very easily have said, you know what, I'm packing up, I'm going home, this was my baby. You want to create a show like this, go ahead, be my guest. But it's sort of like the Garrison Keillor story. If your name is Jim and you change it to Ted, and people might remember to call you Ted, but they're still going to think of you as Jim.
Sure.
And so it was sort of like, you know, if we were going to do a show Saturday afternoons of old time radio, I don't care what you call it. People are going to call it Those Were the Days.
Fair enough.
So, and it's just been an absolute joy. And I feel very fortunate in that all of the little, I don't want to call them hobbies, John, because that does them maybe a disservice, but of all the fancies I've gotten to pursue professionally, both comic books and publishing the Nostalgia Digest and now hosting this show, I'm grateful that I had all of those things in my life because they were able to give me some additional ability to communicate with the world at large. I don't want to sound like I've spent my whole life in my basement, you know.
Understood.
Computer, you
sure.
Know? But it was nice to be able to bridge the sound gap, as we call it, you know, between the 1940s and the 1970s and 80s when I was growing up. And I've no idea where I'm going with this.
Well, no, but I congratulate you on taking what likely started as a hobby and turning it into a profession. And also thank you for keeping alive so many interesting broadcasts because, you know, there's, and certainly now in this internet age, there's a lot of accessibility to radio shows and there are, you know, free sites and people sell shows. But I think Chuck's collection in particular, which I'm assuming obviously you still have access to continuing the show, there's a lot of really interesting stuff that I've never seen for sale anywhere else or online anywhere else. And really interesting programs, and one that we talked about in planning this interview was NBC did this great, special at the beginning of the baseball season that featured a lot of really interesting interviews with umpires and players and managers, and it was narrated by Bing Crosby, and you know it was really cool. And I mean, it's these time capsules, and it's fun to compare the way things were promoted then, and find the similarities and the differences to the way it's done now.
Absolutely, and that's something, I guess, and this is what I probably should have said 5 minutes ago when I was rambling on like an idiot, that, you know, history books do tell us a lot about who won what election, who won what battle, who signed what treaty. That's important. I have no qualms with that. But I think that the shows we feature on Those Were the Days, at least the ones that interested me, they told us something about the state of America that the history books simply don't have the capacity to tell.
Yep.
You know, and the Bing Crosby documentary you talk of is a good example. I mean, this was done around the 1953 World Series, and it really was. It was a fascinating look at the world of baseball before it exploded into this sort of low-level religion that sports had become. You know, I mean, you and I grew up in an age where free agency was starting to take root for the first time, where expansion teams were filling up the leagues. And here was a story of a time when they tried to be realistic and say, look, you may make it all the way to the major leagues. May. And if you do, you might still want to get a winter job.
Absolutely. We're both young enough and old enough, I should say, to remember when we were little kids that there were some guys who had off-season jobs because weren't all. And as you say, free agency was just getting started when we were in grade school and stuff. And I know I remember a lot of 1960s Cubs that were still hanging around in the 70s. And Ron Santo had his businesses. And I remember Ken Holtzman working for a bank and other players for the Cubs and Sox that, you know, had to, like you say, had to have these winter jobs to make ends meet.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And the same with a lot of these shows. You know, a Fibber, McGee, and Molly show from 1942 will tell you something about the state of the country. I mean, whether or not it's related specifically to the war or not, but it's the things people were laughing at. You know, last Saturday, we did an entire show about featuring shows that had been broadcast in the first week of April 1941, 70 years ago exactly. And they really were a fascinating document of a time that I hesitate to say an innocent time, because I don't know what time in our lives is innocent exactly, but certainly it was the last time America wasn't in this sort of state of perpetual war.
Certainly.
That we entered after World War II, where we were going around the globe as policemen. And so it was really, it marked a transition from one part of American history to the next, and I found it very fascinating. And this coming week, we're doing a whole show of programs devoted to the Civil War.
Wow, interesting. You
know, it is, it's fascinating, because if you're able to do the legwork, and I feel fortunate in that a lot of great people did the legwork ahead of me, so that I could then sit and do all the research, or read the books they wrote, you know?
Right.
You know, from there I was able to maybe find some new patterns and find some interesting things to put on the air. So, what is the quote of Isaac Newton? I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
Understood.
But yeah, it's been great and continues to be great.
And
it's, like I say, it's helped me to have some knowledge of pop culture through my comic book career and such as it was, and the times I played music in public and all those things. They all come back together. When you're looking at a show that examines popular culture in American history.
There you go. And also, I think the 20th century, I mean, now that we're moving forward and we're in the internet age, every second of everything from a child's first steps to, you know, I think there are archives of video and everything moving forward that I don't think we have to worry as much about how we record the present for future generations. But really, the 20th century is the last, as the electronic age started happening, you know, that's where there still are pockets of, oh, does somebody have a film of that? We just saw, in fact, at the end of last year, them unearthing the 1960 World Series intact from Bing Crosby's archive. I'm sure you know that story.
That's right. I did hear about that. I've not seen it. Yeah, it is. It's fascinating. And in a way, you know, clearly you can regret, as I do, you would love to think, oh, I wish every moment of every day had been preserved. I wish we could hear a Cubs broadcast from 1938.
You bet.
but in a way, it just makes it all the more special that something did survive, that despite humanity's best efforts, something got preserved. And, you know, it also reminds me of just how fickle a beast history is. You know, when you think about the fact that we're talking about recordings from 50, 60, 70 years ago that are apparently lost to the ages, and then you think back to the Greeks and Romans, and you think, my God, how many stone tablets got shattered?
Absolutely.
You know, there may have been five more commandments we don't know about, you know?
I've seen that movie.
Yeah. That's it's fascinating, and like I say, I've been the beneficiary of a lot of people who did a lot to preserve these things right off the bat, and I'm very, very grateful to them. And if I'm in a position to take what knowledge I've acquired through living and studying and apply it to the presentation of these shows, I'm delighted. You mentioned the internet, and of course, that has changed everything, because now it's very easy to get anything from any time. And with that in mind, I feel a responsibility as the host and producer of a show about these things to try to do something that hopefully goes beyond simply putting on an episode of Dragnet.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. I think your choices in the last couple of years have always been exciting because they do go beyond. I mean, and don't get me wrong, I'm thrilled when we get the dramas and the comedies. But it is those little documentaries and things that just seem like something different and something special that, again, I don't think are available necessarily in any catalog. And, you know, Patton Oswalt, in fact, even wrote an essay about how, and I talked about this with Ed Brubaker the other night, and he kind of lamented how the internet has made it easy for collectors to find things, and he kind of wishes it was the hunt that it was back in the 80s and you know, when he was growing up, and how exciting it was to find something, you know, whether it's a rare movie or you know, God, I remember it was a treat going to Chuck's Metro-Golden-Memory store back in the 70s and 80s and, you know, saved up an allowance or whatever and purchased some records of Gunsmoke. And, you know, I love the westerns and the dramas in particular. And it was really thrilling. And now certainly, you know, yeah, like I say, I mean, there are ways of getting it. Now, you know, your show certainly is available online, and I want to point people to it, both at your website. And then you do an internet radio show on the on Sundays as well.
I do, yeah. As you mentioned, we post every Those Were the Days program at our site for 1 week, and that's nostalgiadigest.com. Then on Sundays, I was offered the chance to do a show for an internet station called yesterdayusa.com. And so I picked up that assignment in March of 2010. I had actually, when I was a freshman in high school, I actually went to the school radio station and somehow managed to finagle my way into getting a two-hour radio show called, which we called Radio's Golden Age. And, of course, I was 14, so it was terrible.
That's all right.
I'm sure I didn't sound anything like this, and I'm not sure if, you know, I sounded like a 14-year-old. And it ran, we did that for about 6 months, and I sort of thought I should keep that name around, though, just in case. And then, lo and behold, 30 years later, the chance to do another show came up, and so we dusted off the name. And like I say, I've been doing that since March of last year.
That's very cool. And so, yes, Yesterday USA.
YesterdayUSA.com, noon to 2 p.m. Central Time.
On Sundays.
Every Sunday afternoon.
Very cool. And you know, I've seen it listed, and I haven't been able to hear it when it's on, but I know also they repeat it. Do they do a 12-hour cycle and then repeat everything?
I think they're working on that. I think in a lot of cases they do. I think our show may be a specialty item by comparison. But you know, I know they've got different shows at different times. I'm not aware of them rebroadcasting ours, but hopefully that will change.
Okay. And is as far as formatically, a lot of times because yours is a Chicago show, we were talking before we started recording that last year you had a very Chicago-centric program, and you featured a lot of neat local old stuff. But for Yesterday USA, is it you know, is there a difference between what you do on Those Were the Days and Yesterday USA?
I would say it's probably a little. It's not Chicago centric.
Sure.
Know, I'm aware of the fact that this is created specifically for a venue whose purpose is to reach a worldwide audience, and so I suppose some of the programs are. We paint slightly broader strokes. We're less likely to do a local show from Chicago or Boston or wherever on Radio's Golden Age. But conversely, you know, we it's also a chance to maybe find some shows of which not a lot of copies are known to exist and pull something out that, you know, maybe isn't first and foremost in people's minds when they think about the Golden Age of Radio, but was certainly part of the equation. I'm just trying to think of an example. I mean, you know, we played a show last year. Tim and Irene Ryan were this vaudeville couple who actually had a summer replacement show for Jack Benny, and we had an episode of that. And, you know, it's 1936. It is not the most sophisticated comedy in the world. But it was part of radio. And, you know, it's like any, you know, history has its high points and its low points. You know, and that's what makes it so interesting. And in fact, Tim and Irene Ryan went on to do a lot more work. Irene Ryan, of course, became Granny on the Beverly Hillbillies.
Absolutely.
So that's
neat.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's neat. As soon as you said Irene Ryan, I knew where you were going, and that's fantastic.
I mean, that's part of what fascinates me is even when you think of something like, oh, the Tim and Irene show. Yeah, who cares? Well, there's a reason to care.
Absolutely.
You know, it's the same sort of thing like, you know, listening to The Shadow from 1937, and you might not think, oh, that's Orson Welles, but it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And so anyway, that's the long and short of it is we try to be, in both cases, as complete about the Golden Age of Radio as we can be, and this second show hopefully allows us to paint in some additional strokes.
That's cool. Now, you mentioned The Shadow, and I want to get into some of the radio heroes, because that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk today. But I am curious, because Chuck's collection initially was such an interesting thing, and I think for comic collectors, they can even appreciate how he kind of came across a bunch of his tapes. Am I correct that he found these things when he was serving in the military? Am I right? Some of these things.
I think it was a little later than that.
Okay.
I think actually, as I understand it, Chuck had, in the 1960s, he had heard this collection of albums by the Longines Symphonette, of all people, which were sort of, you know, a Great Moments of Radio collection.
Okay.
By Jack Benny and Frank Knight. And there were clips of The Shadow and Bob Hope and Jack Benny, of course, and Fred Allen and The War of the Worlds. And I think that's probably what was was galvanizing to him, because I'm sure he may have thought, as a lot of people in the 60s did, oh, well, you know, nobody saved that stuff. You know, it was great to have around, but it's gone. Well, it wasn't gone. And Chuck started to, you know, contact people about collecting and trading, and he found a little network. And I remember him talking to me about this, and he said, you know, that he was just, for the first few years, he was just rolling up his sleeves and trading like a madman, and packages would come to the house every day. And, you know, and over the years, yeah, he acquired an amazing collection, about 40,000 programs.
Crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, and of course, that's part of the beauty of the fact this show's been on the air for 41 years. I mean, we look over some of the shows in our library and realize, my God, 41 years, and this is the first time we're playing it.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, Steve. I think since you took over, at least to me, it seemed like you were digging up shows that maybe Chuck never really, you know, thought of broadcasting before.
Well, I don't want to imply that you know, my sense of programming is anything particularly special in and of itself, but I will say that you know, Chuck and I are coming at this from different generations and possibly from different directions as a result.
Sure.
And, you know, I have, again, not to make any sort of standard of comparison, I would say if when I put these things together, of course, I don't, like you, I don't have the luxury of having lived it. So
right, Chuck grew up listening to this stuff, exactly.
Right, I don't come at it from the point of view of having the memory of listening to the Lone Ranger as a kid. I come at it from the point of view of, oh my God, this was the biggest show on radio.
Right.
Or this is a fascinating, well-done drama, you know, and it doesn't matter if it's 60 years old or not. And there are some shows that really, that are still quite fascinating and of great quality, you know, shows like Gunsmoke, shows like Broadway's My Beat.
Yes.
Shows like Suspense. I mean, Broadway's My Beat is amazing. That is such a warped show.
Well, it's funny. My yes was for Gunsmoke because Jeff Darrow, the wonderful comic artist,
of course,
he and I bonded over Gunsmoke and just how it's such a. In the one sense, it was great that television was invented, and it certainly gave birth to so many other programs. But in the 50s. Radio fidelity had really reached such a wonderful point, and between Jack Webb and the producers of Gunsmoke, they really got into great sound effects, especially on Gunsmoke, where, I mean, my God, it's if people haven't, who are listening to this, have not listened to an episode of Gunsmoke in the 50s, it sounds like somebody opened a microphone in 1870, and you are there. I mean, it's incredible how authentic it sounds.
It's true. I mean, you if you've seen Gunsmoke on television and not heard it on radio, they are two different animals.
Oh, yeah.
And if you've heard gunshots on radio and you've not heard Gunsmoke, then you haven't really heard gunshots on radio. You know, I mean, to get into the technical end, and I'm sure you know this, that of course in the old days of radio, if somebody was firing a gun on radio, of course they'd have blank cartridges, hold it up to the microphone, you know, bang. In the case of Gunsmoke, what the sound technicians did was they actually went to a ravine near the home of the star, William Conrad, and they recorded themselves shooting off guns. Which, of course, so this cavern or this ravine had this natural echo, and then they took it and they actually bypassed the control circuits, I think, at CBS, so that now not only were these realistic sounding gunshots with live echo, they were louder than they'd ever been. Because they bypassed all of the limiters that would have knocked you off the air.
Sure.
So, I mean, it was fascinating, and that's why I think it's unfair to paint any of these shows or any of these times with a very broad brush and say, oh, they were all cliched, or they were all this, or they were all that. And, you know, it's like people tend to assume, for instance, the 1950s were some sort of vanilla, bland, you know, bubble existence.
Right.
And, you know, if you listen to Gunsmoke, if you listen to Broadway's My Beat, or you listen to the CBS Radio Workshop, or X-1, clearly that wasn't the case.
Agreed.
You know, there was a lot of very thoughtful drama being produced and a lot of really good acting.
Yeah, you know, and William Conrad, I mean, we have MeTV in Chicago, and his Cannon reruns are run, or Jake and the Fat Man, and you don't realize when it's just a voice how powerful of an actor William Conrad truly was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just an amazing leading man. And Parley Bear, and I mean, really, that Gunsmoke cast, Howard McNear, Georgia Ellis, they're such, John Daner, not only on Have Gun Will Travel, his own show, but to show up as a character actor on radio before doing the same thing in television and movies for a few decades after that. Just wonderful actors, and really, as you say, amazing writers as well. Go ahead and give me another the rest of the laundry list. Broadway's My Beat, Gunsmoke, CBS Radio Workshop. What other shows should people be listening to?
If you want a list of great radio shows, that's probably longer than we'd have time for. But those were a few. I mean, certainly one of the real pioneers in radio was Norman Corwin.
Yes.
Who was a great writer and director. Norman just turned 100 years old. He'll be 101 next month.
Incredible.
And he's still pretty sharp.
I got your Nostalgia Digest last year when you were celebrating his centennial.
That's right. That's right. In fact, we did put him on the cover with a painting by Alex Ross.
I had no idea. That's fantastic.
It all comes together.
Wow, that's terrific. That's really cool.
Yeah, so I was very and Norman actually saw the painting and he said, "It makes me want to be a better American." I thought, what more could I ask for?
That's fantastic.
No, he was really one of those people who had this marvelous sort of hybrid of poetry and dignity, you know, in the sense that he then is now, you know, he was virulently opposed to fascism and to laws that were unjust and to people that were unjust. And when something happened in the world that really infuriated him, he was able to turn it into his writing. He was able to channel it. And the most famous story is probably that he had read a newspaper account in which a group of Italian bombers had opened fire on Ethiopian cavalrymen. And one of the pilots was Benito Mussolini's son, who later went on the record and described it as exceptionally good fun.
Oh, God.
I know. And Norman Corwin read this, and of course, America was 2 years away from entering the war, but it still infuriated him. And he sat down and wrote this marvelous play called They Fly Through the Air with the Greatest of Ease. And it really, it's this marvelous meditation about the dehumanizing effects of fascism. And, you know, you'd really be hard-pressed to think of a lot of things in any medium that achieved the brilliance that people like Norman could achieve fairly routinely in radio.
You know, and another, the CBS Radio Workshop you mentioned earlier, their adaptation of Brave New World, the Aldous Huxley science fiction, is really disturbing. And as you said, I mean, you think of the 50s as this idyllic time, and it really is still one of the creepiest radio science fiction shows I've ever heard, and it really is all ideas more so than whatever monster you want. I mean, really, the monster is man and what he becomes in the future, and it just works. It really, really works, and it's you know, Corwin, again, as you say, his patriotism was so important before and during the World War II years, and continues. It's great that it's sad that it seems like Canadian radio has been his most frequent employer, I think, in his dotage.
Well, the Canadians, you know, they know of its importance. The British certainly kept it alive as long as they could, and you know, it is a shame. I mean, I would have been quite fascinated to see how One Man's Family, for instance, dealt with the 1960s.
Absolutely, the Carl Nee Morris soap opera that got spanned decades.
Exactly, and it was this sort of ruminative piece on the evolution of a family, and you know, this would have been the sort of thing I think that would have been perfect fodder for him. And, you know, for that matter, the 60s and 70s could have been a fascinating time for American radio drama. Unfortunately, that turned out not to be the case.
You know, and I'm sure you were a fan of the CBS Radio Mystery Theater back in the day as well.
You want to know the truth? Not really.
Really? Interesting.
I mean, partly because I was a kid and it was on fairly late in Chicago when I was growing up. It was on like 10:30 at night.
Yep.
That was kind of a stretch for a 12-year-old. But it did not engage me in the same way that the shows from the 40s and 30s and 50s had.
Understood.
And I don't know why that is.
Well, and there were some good writers then too, and there are some good episodes here and there. It was five nights a week, and it certainly couldn't.
Oh, sure.
It couldn't hold a candle, I think, to William Spear and Corwin and certainly Carlton E. Morris. So I can, I think the golden age of radio certainly had a lot of prime writers and stuff who then later became prime film writers and producers and directors. Blake Edwards, I guess, cut his teeth doing radio.
Blake Edwards was doing radio with Dick Powell, and Norman Corwin, of course, went on to write the screenplay to Lust for Life.
Wow, the film about, and now I'm blanking on the painter.
Oh, about Van Gogh.
Van Gogh, yes, with Kirk Douglas. Yes, what a great movie.
Oh yeah, some brilliant stuff, and of course too, and the actors. A lot of radio actors went on to do pretty well in movies. Alan Ladd is probably the best example.
Yes, Boxer. You know, they just made. You might be interested to know this. A digital comic called Box 13 that absolutely was an adaptation of Alan Ladd's old show.
Fantastic. I know there is a company, I think Moonstone.
You know, I wanted to know your opinion of them, Steve, for our listeners, and they might know because I've done some interviews with them, Chicago publisher that has, I think, reached back and found, if not the public domain characters, in a lot of cases, too, have found the right holders to certain radio and TV properties and brought them back in comic books.
I think it's fascinating. John, I have to confess, I have not really spent a lot of time in comic book stores. Since I wrote my last book.
Understood.
So I would not be in a position to judge on the quality of it. I thought it was, but I think it's a fascinating idea, and I wish them every success. I mean, and, you know, certainly if somebody can take those characters and reveal their greatness to the 21st century readers, I can only think that's a good thing.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about some of these radio heroes.
Sure.
that went on to comics, and now that we're kind of back in the world of comics as well. But we were talking as we set up this interview about Frank Stryker, the guy from Detroit who was responsible for two big radio heroes that also became big comic strip and comic book heroes as well.
That's right. That's right. He had been one of the guiding forces behind the Lone Ranger. He had been writing scripts in Buffalo, New York. And the fact is, as you probably know, the origins, the actual origins of the Lone Ranger, are always going to be up for debate. You know, this is a little one of those smoke-filled room stories.
Sure.
But Fran Stryker certainly had a hand in creating some of the mythology surrounding the Lone Ranger that we know today. George W. Trendle, who owned the station where the Lone Ranger was created, the story went that he wanted to create a hero who would be the embodiment of living prayer.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
And so they wanted somebody who would be, you know, stalwart, and, you know, he would shoot to disarm but never to kill. He would never drop his G's. He wasn't the sort of guy who you know, made jokes or, you know, kissed women and said, no, I'd rather have my horse or anything like that, you know. And that's, of course, the characterization that stayed with the show for years, both on radio and, of course, later on television. He also, of course, had a hand in the Green Hornet, which was also a creation of WXYZ. And I'm always fascinated because there are people, even when the Green Hornet movie came out, I guess there were reporters who contacted people I know to interview them about the Green Hornet, and These reporters had no idea this show had been around for 75 years.
Exactly.
You know, but in the same token that the Ranger was meant to be the embodiment of living prayer, my understanding is that George W. Trendle, seeing how successful that had been, had issued an edict to his staff saying, you know, we should do something now about freedom of the press, because people need to know that there are a lot of forces out there that can undo the good that we've done in this world, and you know, a vigilant press has to handle that. And that was part of the impetus for the creation of the Green Hornet. I've a couple friends, Martin Grahams and Terry Salmonson, who've actually written a fairly exhaustive tome about the Green Hornet. And I recommend it highly. So.
That's really cool. And, you know, this was all pre-Superman, but much like the Green Hornet and the Lone Ranger, Superman, too, was kind of a response to certainly urban corruption. And, you know, I mean, and if you read those early action and Superman comics, it's right there in the first couple of years. And it slowly went away. But, yeah, I mean, it is kind of neat that that's why these characters were created, and to you know, warn the public of... Like you say, the dangers of you know, the forces that were surrounding them.
Right. I mean, that not to be complacent, that actually you want to elect candidates who will actually do something to battle corruption or poverty or whatever the case might be. And yeah, it's fascinating to read those early Superman comics because, of course, you know, that was before he developed a mythology. But you're right. He spent so much time, as we say, battling slumlords and warlords.
Yeah.
That to see him become this sort of globetrotter amongst the universe, you know, must have been kind of jarring.
Well, you know, and I guess, again, because of the wonder of science fiction, and certainly you think of guys like Julie Schwartz and Mort Weisinger that came from those science fiction backgrounds and were the editors of Superman and stuff, it's not surprising that after a while he was pushing planets and, you know, solving universal problems as well. I'm sure you've seen that wonderful... two-page comic that Siegel and Schuster made, how Superman would have ended the war in Europe.
Oh, sure, of course.
And grabbing, Hitler and I want to say Mussolini or Stalin.
Well, Stalin was in there too, of course, before we had to make friends with him.
Exactly. And not in front of the United Nations, but the League of Nations of the 30s that unfortunately disbanded before World War II, before America's involvement in World War II.
And it's really fascinating to hear Superman on radio because this is another case of people maybe not being aware of just how important this media was to Superman. Not only because he was now going to be on the air 5 days a week, but in terms of the actual trappings of Superman, a lot of that came about through the radio. I mean, the radio show is what made Jimmy Olsen kind of a central character.
Yeah.
And, of course, as we were saying earlier, the radio show invented kryptonite.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it was solely because Clayton Collier, the actor, had a vacation. And they couldn't think of replacing him, so they said, well, we better create something that will render Superman virtually mute for the next 2 weeks.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. And from small things, you know, big things come.
Wow, that is crazy. And I know, too, you know, I mentioned to friends over the weekend, a bunch of comic creators got together at an art showing, and we were talking, and someone said, well, yeah, I think it was radio where Look Up in the Sky, It's a Bird, It's a Plane all came
from.
That's
correct, yes.
You know,
yeah, in fact, I had occasion to interview Jackson Beck, the radio announcer who was responsible for narrating The Adventures of Superman. And even in his 80s, he still sounded like that.
That's terrific.
That, you know.
And, of course, we'll mention his other great role in radio and cartoons.
Oh, as Bluto.
Absolutely. Popeye's nemesis. Yes, indeed.
And, in fact, he had a lengthy association with comics as well, because when Superman ended its run, he went on to become the narrator when Kellogg sponsored a series based on Mark Trail.
Oh, wow.
So, That's part of this that's fascinating to me, John. And we were talking about the heroes in comics and radio, and it is fascinating to see just how many of them made the transition from one media to another. Sometimes those heroes stood the test of time, as was the case with Superman or the Lone Ranger, and others, for whatever reason, didn't. You know, I mean, there was actually a radio version of the Blue Beetle.
Yes, I gotta say, I haven't been able to really listen to an entire episode because it just didn't hold up. I mean, and I guess that's one of the reasons why it wasn't successful in moving on. But yeah, it was amazing to see that this Fox Comics, the old pre-Ted Kord, and now I'm blanking on his name, Dan Garrett.
Dan Garrett,
absolutely, the policeman. And, yeah, that original 30s and 40s Blue Beetle, the Victor Fox Blue Beetle.
Absolutely. And the same with, you know, like Hop Harrigan, who appeared in All-American Comics. He had a regular daily show. A lot of characters from the books and strips moved to radio for various lengths of time. I mean, Flash Gordon actually was on the air for a time, played, ironically, by Gail Gordon.
Oh, that's awesome. Mr. Mooney from the Lucy Show.
I know.
Terrific. Playing Flash
and
Gordon.
It's funny because you and I know Gail Gordon was brilliant at comedy. Absolutely brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
But that was the beauty of radio is, you know, he could slip into a dramatic role if needed.
What?
And the same with all of those actors.
Well, and even William Conrad, as great as he was as a leading man, was hilarious as the narrator in Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Absolutely.
So you're right. I mean, no, and you know, it is funny, especially hearing cartoon voices for years and watching the cartoons and then hearing a lot of those guys back in the old radio days, Paul Frees and Hans Conried, and Hans Conried doing a very dramatic and terrific version of The Most Dangerous Game on Escape.
Yes.
You know,
yes, I was actually just playing that the other day. He's marvelous.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so there's another great radio show, much like Suspense, that, you know, people who are maybe new to old radio should take a listen to and enjoy some episodes of those shows.
That's true. Escape was pretty flawless during its time on the air. And an interesting story about Hans Conried. I love this story. Leonard Maltin wrote about it in his book, The Great American Broadcast, that Hans Conried and another actor were talking, and I guess Linda Darnell walked by, no relation. And the other actor said something admiring about Linda Darnell, and Hans Conried's response apparently was, "Oh, I'll bet she can't do one dialect."
Who cares?
Yeah, really. Yes, but when you look like that, I wouldn't care what language you spoke.
Absolutely, man. Too funny.
But there were. You're right, and this is the thing we can kid about. You know, juvenile shows from the 30s or 40s or soap operas from the 30s or 40s. But in fact, you know, people and children hung on to those things religiously. And part of the reason for that was because the talent was there.
Yeah.
You know, the Superman show, of course, had Clayton Collier and Jackson Beck and the wonderful Joan Alexander as Lois Lane. You know, Flash Gordon had Gail Gordon on there as in the title role. And there were a number of shows like that that had come out of the strips, like Terry and the Pirates and Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. And they all survived for a fairly long time on radio.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I even recently purchased a DVD set and saw what I guess was either a 50s, like, Monogram or Equal, you know, kind of Poverty Row movie studio trying to do a new version of The Shadow, or that it was a possible unsold TV pilot. It was called Invisible Avenger, and it was, you know, really rough, and it was an attempt at a Shadow TV, you know, like I said, a movie or TV show, and obviously just did not have the ability of the, you know, theater of the imagination that radio is to really convey a much bigger idea in your mind versus the limits of a crappy studio trying to do it, you know, with a guy in an overcoat and a mask and a hat. It just didn't work.
Right, and of course, no studio in the 50s could do anything as actually violent as Walter Gibson's stories either.
Yeah.
and that's to radio's credit, that they took the limitations of censorship or whatever, the standards of the network, and they made them work. And I'm always fascinated. I mean, there is something to be said for pure, unfettered creative control. I don't want to speak against that by any means. But there's also something fascinating in people who have limitations and still make it work.
Sure.
You know, when you realize, you think of shows like The Shadow or Lights Out, the intent of which was to be scary within the limits of the law.
Right, and still manage to gross people out, I mean, in a good way. I mean, Arch Obler, Lights Out. Yeah, the Rod Serling of his time, for people who may not know who Arch Obler is.
That's true. Arch Obler did a number of really memorable stories on Lights Out, and one in particular that's very popular still with our audience is called The Dark, in which a strange fog creeps across this house, and all of the inhabitants are turned inside out.
I know that one well.
It is something, I've listened to a recording of that made in the 60s, and it's almost too intense. Which is strange to say for the fact that you don't actually see anything.
Was that an album that he had done in the 60s?
Yes, he did an album for Capitol Records called Drop Dead.
Yep.
which had that story and the story of the chicken heart that kept growing, and a handful of others as well.
Yeah, Bill Cosby, of course, made the chicken heart story famous in his old comedy routines.
It's true. It's outside of your door. Oh, my God. Oh, I got my Jell-O.
That's easy.
Oh, my God, I love that. I can quote that entire thing verbatim.
Oh, no, I'm with you, man. That's hilarious. No, that's good stuff. And, you know, that's the thing, and I'm glad we've branched out beyond radio here to talk about some of these other areas of old-time radio as well. It's really an interesting world, and I credit you for being able to have both the Nostalgia Digest and the two programs as well to be able to explore it and present it in a way that I think does continue to excite new listeners and stuff. So congratulations on all of it, Steve.
Thank you very much, John. It's like Jiffy Pop, you know. It's as much fun to make as it is to eat.
Here you go. And no, it's a pleasure talking to you, and I hope we'll have the opportunity to talk again in the future and maybe talk about some of these other subjects in that. You've got to be a big Me TV and Me Too fan.
I am. I like everybody, this last year I went through my Wild Wild West phase.
Very good.
which, of course, featuring former radio actor Ross Martin.
Yeah, absolutely.
you know, it's great fun. And you know, as you say, when toward the end you talk about, you know, when we get off on subjects beyond radio or beyond comics, I think that's the fascinating stuff about this. If you come into anything with an open mind, it will open so many doors to so many places. And
absolutely.
I was fortunate enough to discover radio and comics at reasonably young ages, and they in turn led me to other places that I might not have thought about prior to that. So I'm very grateful to both of them.
Very cool. And people can get the Nostalgia Digest through your website as well?
Yes, nostalgiadigest.com for the show, the magazine, old-time radio shows on compact disc. It's all there.
Fantastic. And no, thanks again, Steve. I really appreciate your time today, and I look forward to future broadcasts of your programs and future issues. So keep up the good work.
Thanks very much, John. I appreciate it.
We talked about the Superman radio serial. I felt it necessary to mention the passing of Stetson Kennedy, a great old journalist who is famous for infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan and writing about them in the 1930s, but further was able to put the Klan into the Superman serial and wrote a very interesting story about the Klan. So there's a little tie to our subject today, and I wanted to acknowledge the passing of Stetson Kennedy. Do yourself a favor, Google that name and read this guy's incredible life history. But that'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. Thanks to Steve Darnall. Make sure you check out his show, Those Were the Days, which is at NostalgiaDigest.com. It's also broadcast here in Chicago on WDCB Radio, and you can also listen to it live when it airs from 1 in the afternoon until 5 every Saturday afternoon. Today's episode was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. We mentioned some of the savings that you'll find at InStock Trades. For example, you can get the Uncle Sam Deluxe Hardcover Edition, written by Steve Darnall, drawn by Alex Ross. The standard retail price, $19.99, at InStockTrades.com, just $12.39. In addition, Moonstone Books has a lot of great adaptations and updates of some great old-time radio heroes. You can find all the Moonstone Books at InStockTrades.com for 25% off the standard retail price. Check out the deals. They are waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. John Sutcher saying thanks again for listening to today's Word Balloon episode. This week is the New York Comic Con. I will be there wandering the aisles. No panels for me this year, but that's okay. If you see me, make sure you say hello, and let me thank you for listening to Word Balloon as much as you do. I truly appreciate it. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Questions or comments for the show, reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com, the comments page at wordballoon.com, or of course the talkback at iFanboy, where you'll find Word Balloon every week. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2011.